Cheers. Well, welcome back from the break.
We are back. Let's see, module 5 is where we are. This is Microsoft Virtual Academy. You're watching Building, Developing Universal Apps with C# and XAML. We've been talking a lot around design, structuring your applications, things like that. Now we're gonna really be talking about something every application probably needs and uses, and that's the idea of data on the server. And so we're gonna walk through building a web service. We're gonna walk through, you might think, wow, how is this a universal app? Because it's used by universal apps, and often it's done in a way that makes it way more difficult than it needs to be. And we're gonna talk about some of the tricks that you can do to make it even cooler and easier and useful, and it's just great. And one of the ways we'll do it is we'll use code generation. It's all gonna be web API. It'll be great.
It's gonna be awesome.
It's gonna be awesome. All right, so specifically we're gonna talk about the database project that comes with Visual Studio, building a service, building the client, and this idea around property validation and extending your model so that it's really, really rich. Things that, it's just a built-in requirement for most line of business applications. All right, so let's begin with the database project, Darren.
Sounds like a good plan.
All right. So in this case, we're going to use Azure, if that's all right with you, and we'll go through the whole thing. So let me open up Visual Studio here, and I'm going to create a database project. That'll be how I start.
Excellent.
So this is a template that ships with Visual Studio. You can find it right inside the SQL Server node of the new project dialog, and you just spin it up. What's great about this is it's one project for all the different types of SQL Server databases out there. So I could go from 2005 all the way up to SQL Azure. And so this is gonna be the SQL Azure database that we're going to use. And of course, now that I have we'll just call it a blank database, the first thing that I do is start building out the schema that we're gonna use. Everything's gonna be represented in files. These are gonna be just T-SQL files. So I'll create this tables folder and I'll put in the user's SQL file. And so that's just where we're gonna define the table. So right here I can use, you can see the designer. And it kind of feels like actually the SQL designer that we have in the regular management studio for SQL. And if you look below, you can see it's building out the SQL at the exact same time. Now what's stored in the file is this right here, the SQL itself. So I can go in, if I know SQL really well, I don't even have to touch to the designer. I can start building out, monkeying with it however I want, adding indexes and things like that, or I could use the designer for everything. The other thing that I want to add now is, because this is a development machine, I want to go to the user scripts and add a post-deployment script. The post-deployment script will execute after my database gets pushed out to Azure. What this means is I'll push out an empty schema, then I'll be able to run this post-deployment script and fill it with the sample data that I need to. So here I'm going to just use a simple insert statement, and I'm going to insert me. And I'll also I'll insert you too, Darren. How about that? That'll be perfect. And we'll have three users that we'll use. I'll just copy this down. Now, even though I'm using raw data here, you know, just typing things in T-SQL, I certainly have the option, this is just regular SQL, I certainly have the option to call out to another database, pull the data in from there. So maybe our development team maintains a really rich sample database that we can use, or perhaps with you know, some of our enterprise ETL tooling, we're actually pulling down production data, scrubbing out the personal information that's in that data, and using that in our development environment so it's more realistic. Fantastic. Whatever it is we want, that's what we're going to do. Now look what I have here. This is the rename capability. So this project gives you a lot of stuff around symbolic renaming. So see how it's changed from users to players in both of the places. Now this is a really valuable thing. I need to change the name of the users table. If it's in referenced in views, indexes, if it's referenced deep inside stored procedures, all of that gets fixed as well. So I've created the table, I've created the post-deployment script, we've looked at the symbolic renaming inside it, which is really cool. I even can get some build time checking on it as well. All right, so let's go into Azure here, and take a look at...
You're looking at the database and server name.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So if I'm going to deploy it, I got to figure out which database, or which server, not database, I'm going to deploy it to. So I've picked this one, this HS9 whatever, but I got to make sure that
IP address.
That the IP address is open for my development machine. This is a common mistake where I deploy a brand new server up into Azure, but I don't open up the necessary IP addresses so that I can touch it from wherever I'm developing. So I'm going to go ahead and grab a copy of the server name here. I'll use that to create a connection. The easiest way for us to check and see how things are going is by using the SQL Server Object Explorer. This is built in to Visual Studio. And so I'll paste in the server name. I see I already had it because I had kind of gone through this before. And put in the username and password here. And as soon as I do, it'll connect up and allow me, almost like I'm in SQL Server Management Studio, to go into and kind of spelunk into that server and see what databases we have. Look what we have. We have Solarizer database that we use for the demo app that we put together. All right, so now I'm going back to my database project. I'm going to publish this up to... Azure, and the way I'll do it is almost the same process, really. I'll create a, not deploy, but publish. I'll create a connection up to it using a publish profile. So first, let me build out the connection. I still have that in my clipboard. It's the same SQL admin username, and I'll check the connection only by attaching to master. So this is going to be a quick test just to make sure I can connect up there. Again, one of the common reasons this doesn't work is because we didn't fix all the IP addresses to be open for where the developers are. So I can, right here, create the profile. I click that. It saves a file into the project. That'll get checked into source control so that you can use it as well when you're ready to deploy it on your own. So that part's really nice. This is going to be our Galactic attack for our app that we just put. And it will create the database even though there's nothing there yet. You can see I kind of worked through this before. I had a little bit of stuff going on. That spinner is going to go, and it's going to do all the stuff for me, including go out, see if the database is there so it can create the create database script, see if what the schema is like so it can create alter scripts that are necessary, and eventually execute it against the database as well. So let's go see if it worked. First things first, I will... Let me refresh the list of databases here in SQL or in Azure so I can see if this server now has three databases instead of two. There, Galactic attack, the one we just submitted. And you can see the list of tables here. We should only have that one table. Remember, it was the users table that we used renaming to rename to the players table. And you know what we might use this for is, you know, maintaining that high score log, you know, to see who the leaderboard is and things like that. So there it is. So we can see that it's there. Let me open it up and see if just the data is there. So remember, first we are going to deploy the schema. We're going to create the database, deploy the schema, and then we're also going to run that post script so we can have sample data. What's beautiful about this, I could run this over and over and over again. I probably have my own SQL database or MSDN subscription because I'm a developer, just like you do, so we all can deploy up to our own context. We can have a fresh database, a fresh schema, and a fresh set of data. I can get all this working, check it into code source control, let you get latest, you deploy it, and you have the best new database as well. We're all using the shared identical piece.
And it works really well for if you're doing continuous integration where you might have an overnight build that tears a test database down, repopulates it, and so on. And the other great thing about this is it manages deltas, you know, that you can also, not only starting from a fresh database, you can do changes to the schema. It'll detect the changes and actually generate scripts to do those migrations for you.
Yeah. I don't have to have a SQL database local, but if I do, it works the same there. I also don't have to have the Management Studio tools installed, and I don't really need to know very much about T-SQL. If I need to go in and add an index, it has all the same visual designers that the Management Studio has as well. Pretty nice.
Yeah, excellent demo.
The database project handles deployments, comparisons, and refactoring. Those are the three things it really delivers, but I might add one more thing to that. It also offers to put it, the schema in source control. A pretty cool option that I can go back to last Monday's schema. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you are monkeying with the schema directly, there's no such thing in SQL Server. I mean, I guess if you're doing daily backups, you could restore back to that date.
Yeah.
But that's a very clumsy way to do it.
It's the same, you know, if you're monkeying around with the stored procedures and so on and so forth, you can do a lot of that. You know, you do a lot of monkeying around with the database, though.
We do a lot of monkeying around, Barry. All right. All right, let's talk about it. So we have the database. The next logical step, you know what? I'm going to pull up our app real quick and just show you. So here's the Universal app, and I'll just remind you of the structure that here on the server, we have a database project. We follow the same piece, right? It's just got a handful of tables in it, but we do it right here. And now we're going to build out the web service project. So how are we going to take the database, expose it up to our server? No, expose it up to our client. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we're going to create either a website or a dedicated service on Azure or in our local IIS or whatever it is we have. Okay. I'm monkeying around with all these. Oh my gosh, Barry! No!
They beamed him up.
Oh, Scotty, you're so right. All right. Let's talk about the complementary technologies around web services. Barry, you.
I've been waiting for that all day.
That was awesome. All right, so there is a lot of complexity around all of this.
I just want to make sure everybody else saw that too, didn't they?
What are you talking about? I didn't see anything. Yeah. I don't know what you're talking about. All right. So we're talking about web APIs. Now, the reason we're talking about web APIs and not WCF services is not because anything's wrong with WCF services. Mm-hmm. It's specifically because web API is certainly becoming the most popular implementation for exposing data from a service.
Yep, it's great. It's a very lightweight framework.
That's right.
You know, WCF really, to a certain extent, was infinitely customizable,
yep.
Which therefore meant it was almost infinitely complex in terms of all of the options.
So easy to get wrong.
Yes.
I think we loved it because we could build a proxy from the client down, and mm-hmm. all the stuff was kind of automagic.
It was great in terms of discovery. It supported all manner of different protocols, you know, from a custom binary over TCP through to, you know, the SOAP-based protocols, and also supported REST.
It did, that's right. A lot of people didn't realize that it had all that built into it. But it does ship off SOAP. A lot of people now see SOAP as really a heavy way to send mm-hmm. data across the wire. If you look at JSON, JSON's very, very, very lean, just gets the job done. And honestly, it's performant and great.
Yeah, I mean, the web standards guys have pulled together a number of different technologies that allow you to incorporate similar levels of security in REST-based elements in terms of signing. SSL certs can be very, very complex now, 2048 bytes and so on and so forth, as well as including JSON web tokens mm-hmm. for authentication for distributed OAuth through services and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of capability in there now that didn't exist previously. It's just
the web API is basically built on top of MVC or ASP.NET for MVC projects, so it's something very familiar to mm-hmm. web developers already. And so we're also going to talk about, since we're talking complementary technologies, we're also going to talk about the Entity Framework. And so this is a shim between you and the database, and it does all that database work for you, and you get to interact with it as if it's objects, and you let it do the translation up to a SQL Server for you. That's pretty nice from an abstraction point of view. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be SQL Server. It can talk to other types of databases as long as those providers are available.
Correct.
Yeah. And then we're going to kind of get into the T4 templates, because as soon as we use Entity Framework, that introduces T4 templates for code generation, and we can use their code generation templates and kind of use them for our good. And I'll demonstrate all that so we can get a feel for it.
And to be clear, you don't have to have Entity Framework to be able to leverage T4. T4 is a technology that's available inside Visual Studio and so on. What we're talking about here is that the later versions of Entity Framework leverage T4 for producing models and so on, and they provide you extension points so you can plug into that T4 template and actually customize it.
Yep, you're absolutely right. In fact, One of the benefits of the Unity framework is it gives us compile time validation.
Go back the slide just for a second.
Sure.
Make sure it is ideal for boilerplate code.
Who says boil? That's ridiculous. Bloiler, wait a minute.
Boilerplate.
Boilerplate code, that's ridiculous. Chris.
I know.
Poor guy.
Where was your QA?
Yeah, poor. We're waiting for Chris to catch us. He's just an inch behind on the time scale. What it's like to live in a different dimension. All right, boilerplate, yes. All right, so the Unity framework gives us, gives developers this compile time validation. Very unusual. When I'm writing a SQL statement, SQL statements usually don't have that kind of compile time validation.
Of course.
I'm shipping it off as a string.
Yeah, I mean, you can still with Entity Framework use raw strings and so on and so forth if you really
want to. You can unwind all the value of the Unity Framework if
exactly,
you want to.
If you really, really wanted to. Why?
That's right.
That's a different question.
T4 templates, on the other hand, they should not be placed in shared projects. We talked about it. We certainly want to bring those up to the client, and I'll demonstrate how to use those for sure. So let's start with just the service. So remember in the previous demo, we built out the
database.
Now let's build out just the simplest possible service. All right. Beautiful. We'll start with the Unity model. The Unity framework will do everything for us, right? And so I'll just add this to it. What we'll start with is a project to put it in.
Yeah, we need the web API project.
Yeah, we need the web API project. So now all the different ASP.NET projects have been rolled into a single template, which is very cool. And then a little wizard walks us through which one we want it to do. So to keep things as simple as possible, just so we can talk about what we have, I'll pick the empty, and then I'll select just web API. So now there's as little as possible. So the first thing I'll do inside the models folder here, I'll search for the Unity data model. There it is, ADO.NET Unity data model. Those other DB connections are for code first and other pieces like that. So the first thing it says is, what database do you want to use? Do you want to pull it down from? And I could build all this by hand, but I'd rather have it import from a database. So I still have that in my clipboard. I'll paste in the server and put in the username and password that I know here, right? It's Galactic Attack. Remember, it only has the player's database. I'll check the connection, and it's good. And now we'll keep going through the Entity Framework wizard. And so in this case, it gives us a choice whether or not it's going to be Unity Framework 5 or 6. We definitely want 6. And then we go in and say, which tables do we want to include in our framework? We really only have one that we care about. So we'll go ahead and pick it. And you'll see it represented as an entity, right? Mm-hmm. Right here inside the model. Now, from here, we could do anything we want, including extend it. So we have other properties as well. But this just brings down those three properties. And from this point forward, we now have a player class with three properties, the ID property, the username property, and the high score property. We can certainly query the database against any of those, but we can also read and write from those and send them back to the database, always interacting with the database as if it's a class.
Sounds good.
Yeah, so the Unity framework, that's what it does for us. It creates not only the shim between the database and us, but this proxy class so we can interact with it as if it's regular C# class. What's neat is how it does it. And so let's take a look. I'm going to, let's see here. Let's build, take what we have so far, and let's see. That's funny. The touch targeting's not 100%, so I couldn't get it, you know what I mean? I was really, really trying. All right, so the first thing we'll do is we'll add yet another project. Remember, this is gonna be the project that we share between everything. So this is where all the models are gonna live. So we'll intentionally pick a portable universal app project. This is that PCL, kind of what we looked at before.
Allows us to target the Windows runtime.
That's exactly right. So I'll make sure that it goes to the Windows runtime. I'll switch it over to 4.5 instead of 4.5.1 so I don't have to monkey with the web service. And I'll include a reference to that new common project in the web service. All right, so what have we done so far? We've created the new portable class, and we've also created now the folder that we're gonna put all of our models into. So it's just a models folder, no big deal. I'll delete the base class that comes with it. Now it's a matter of using all the code generation tools that come with Entity Framework. Mm-hmm. So these are the TTs, or T4 templates. Yeah, you know what T4 stands for?
Yes, I do. Do you?
I don't. I can never remember. That's why I kind of, yeah. What is it?
Ooh, T-Templation.
Stop.
Templating.
All right, so let's look at all the files that are created. It's the TT we care for, that we care about. So we're going to grab that and drag it into the models folder of our common project. Now, that TT is all set up wrong because, look, it's looking for model 1 EDMX, which doesn't exist in the local folder. In fact, I have to back down to the root, then I have to back down to the solution, and then go up to the web service. So as soon as I update that, though, I'll save it, and it'll automatically run and generate the files that I need, right? And so we'll look at those in just a second. But before I do, let's clean up. I'm going to delete the one, yep, delete the old TT that we have in the web solution. So let me just delete it. It's not that big of a deal. And now
the power of the internet brings us text template transformation toolkit.
Oh, nice work. Nice work. Now I'm going to say common.models in the namespace. This means that when the Entity Framework builds its proxies, it's looking for all the models in that new namespace, which basically means it's looking up in the common project for us. So now they're no longer being created here. Instead, they're being created up in the common folder, which we can use later. Now I'm just going to add a basic controller. It's nice because the controller templates allow us to pick from the Entity model that's in that solution. Really cool scaffolding. In fact, look at this. I'm not going to do anything. I'm just going to close it. And so now that controller is built. That's the read, write, and all the information we need to access players. This is a fun thing to play with too. If you try to build the controller first, obviously you don't have all of this that it'll build out for you. Mm-hmm. But even that scaffolding is using T4 behind the scenes. Yep. You just don't get to see the files. So here's what we've done. We've created the Entity model that talks to the database. We've moved the models themselves up into a shared project. And then what we've done is created just a basic no-frills controller so we can read and write from that one table. Of course, we only have one table. Web API is really a REST solution. Did you say you figured out the T4 thing?
T4, yes. It was a text template transformation toolkit.
Of course it is.
Yes. Just rolls off the tongue.
Microsoft can do something like that, naming like that. Only one company in the world is capable of a name like that.
Well, we're lucky that's not version 4 Service Pack 2.
Exactly.
Update 1.
All right. Nonetheless, REST services also mean I can interact with them just like a simple service, right? I don't have to have a complex client proxy or anything like that. I just talk straight to it using HTTP client. In fact, let's talk about building out the web API client, and it's just a HTTP client anyway. Yeah. Now, before we do, we're going to use the JSON.NET, but the Newtonsoft JSON.NET. I have long since enjoyed how fast and easy it is to use this library in your application, or in any application. I mean, it works freaking everywhere.
Yeah, well, it's actually been acknowledged pretty much globally that it's the most high-performance JSON library in the .NET framework, to the point where it actually ships as part of .NET MVC, ASP.NET MVC.
That's right. Pretty awesome. And then we'll interact with and use the common models that we just created, right? Because now those can be shared because we made sure that those were WinRT PCLs. Mm-hmm. We made sure that those could be shared with our client. And we're going to use the new Windows HTTP client. This was introduced just at Build 2014, right? Just when Windows 8.1 update.
Yep.
Yeah, that's where it was. Anyway, it gives us a fully asynchronous HTTP client, as well as one that's projected into every language so we get a consistent implementation across them all.
Which is pretty handy.
It is handy. All right, so let's take a look at what we're doing now. We just created the controller. Now I'm going to go and create the client. I'll create the Windows Universal client so we can kind of see the whole thing across the board. So I'll just add it to this solution. Obviously, I would like to use solution folders to group things together in client and server and things like that, right? But we can rearrange that later. Blank is good enough for me because I'm really not going to be doing very much. I just want to show the access of the data from the client. So inside the Windows client here and inside the phone client, they both have the XAML. I don't want to mess around with that. I'm going to create my own main page down here in shared. This basically means that I'm going to implement it for both Windows and Windows Phone. And I'll do this one right. I'll put our views in a view folder, just like we talked about in our conventions. No harm in that. So a blank page is all we need. I'm not going to do any UI whatsoever. I'm just going to do the implementation behind the scenes. And so I'll create the client. And let's not forget two really important things. We're going to be using the common project, so I need to make a reference to it. Now remember, you do not make a reference inside a shared project. You make a reference inside the individual head projects. As far as NuGet though, I'll be able to do, I'm going to install NuGet, and I still already have the checkbox. Let me install NuGet individually, and I can figure that out later. And so I'll make sure that common is referenced, and then I'll go inside phone here, and I'll make sure that common is referenced there as well, and it says regular solution. There you go. So now they both have JSON.NET, and they both have a common reference. They do have JSON.NET, don't they? Well, let me...
I guess you tied it that up.
Yeah, okay. So let me install JSON... Exactly. Well, whatever. I'll do the same thing for phone. That way, they both have the references that they need, right? So we'll just pull that up. NuGet makes life so easy. And the fact that now we can set it up so that the solution will pull down all the NuGet files that I put on my project, check it in, you get it on your side, and it just sets it all up for you.
Mm-hmm.
It's really nice. All right, so these are important references to make sure that your heads all reference the common. And the JSON.NET is just because we're going to deserialize some stuff. Let me go into that XAML page, the code behind of the XAML. I'll implement everything there. And because this is going to be asynchronous, it's going to be hard to do in the constructor. So let me go ahead and override the onNavigatedTo. Every page gets this out of the box. And one of the nice things is I can make it asynchronous. So I just pasted in this block, right? Because I didn't want you to watch me type. I hate pasting in blocks, but let me show you what it does. It's just the HTTP client, where I set the header so that it accepts JSON. That really communicates to the server, and then I actually communicate the call. The call checks for the status and then fetches the string, and then using Newtonsoft, we just deserialize it. And basically, we're taking that JSON string and turning it into one of the classes that are set up in our models. It's as easy as that. So here's how I'll interact with this reusable method, right? So first thing will be the server. I can't remember exactly what the server is, so let me go to the properties of the web service project. In the web project, you see it's right here, localhost, and a number I could never have guessed correctly. I mean, that's ridiculous. But you know, if I had already deployed this up, this would be on Azure or something like that instead. Now, the next thing I need to do is I need to take the service and combine it with the server. And so I guess in reality, the server base automatically has API appended to it. So it's HTTP localhost / API, and you get that for free because you're using web API. I'm going to be using players. That's the players controller that we created a couple of demos ago. And the path object does this automatically for me. I don't have to worry about slashes or anything like that. It does everything properly. So now I'm going to create a players object just by calling out to the service. And so this needs to be asynchronous so that I can call this async method. And I'll say await get async, and I tell that what I need it to deserialize for into. So in this case, it's just deserializing into an enumerable of models.player. And that's a shared model, the one that is in that common PCL. And it's going to go get it from, what's the URI, the one that I just built here called service. I will transform it into a URI format rather than a string. And then let's break here so that we can see what actually occurs. I think it's as easy as that, to be honest. Let me go ahead and debug it and see what happens here. I got a little error. And let's see here.
Oh, yeah, because you moved your main page into views.
Oh, yeah, I deleted them, but it was doing the base navigation. There we go. All right, so I'm going to change the startup here so that two things start up at the same time. I'm going to make sure that Windows starts up. So here we go. I'll go ahead and start it, and I'll make sure also that our web page, that web service here starts up as well, because we're going to need that. It's not up on a web server anywhere, so I need to launch it right here inside IIS Express. And so I'll hit F5 here. You can see it's starting to build. It builds successfully. Very nice. And it'll launch both the app and the web service here. I'll just wait just a second. Well, let me try.
Oh, it helps if you actually have the Windows client as the startup rather than the API.
And you know what I did while I had it like that too? I switched it over so I could run it in the simulator as well. I think it'll be nicer to have so it's not full screen. We would have missed a little piece there as well. All right, so here it's running. Remember, there's no UI in this application. It goes straight back into the code behind. So let me hop over to the code behind here. And it will pause right here. There we go, line 35, the break that I put in there. And let's see what's in service. You can see it built out the URI just like I would hope it would. And look, I've got three of them. The first one, Jerry Nixon, just like our sample data that we had. The second one, there you are, Darren. Second,
there I am, look at my school.
And then we got Sam Stokes as number three. Pretty awesome.
Sam is apparently pretty awesome at Galactic Attack.
His score is one of the highest high scores there is. No doubt about it. All right, so there it is. Well, this is the easy way to consume the data that's being given to us by a web API. Mm-hmm. There's more that you'll show tomorrow. We're going to go through security. And one of the things, and it's amazingly simple, yep. where we added the header that allows us to basically communicate, hey, send back JSON to me, you'll also be adding the token necessary for us to communicate to it securely. Really cool. Really
yep,
cool option.
But
we'll show that later. But it's basically the same code with one extra line, and all of a sudden it's secure communication with our web API.
Yeah, it's pretty slick. And I have to say that the SDK teams have really worked very hard to make the story a lot simpler than it used to be.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. They're trying and consistent across all the different platforms as well. All right, so web API clients use HTTP client, especially in universal apps where HTTP client in the Windows namespace is available to you, and the JSON and a JSON deserializer. You don't have to use JSON.NET if you don't want to, but certainly it's a great option, super normal. Almost every developer uses it, so there's really no reason not to. All right, there are the three things. I'm going to jump over. Before we do this, let me jump over so I can show you this. This is what we did as well, right? So we have the database and the web service, and inside this shared project is our models that we moved all the T4s to, and then, of course, we have our two head projects. They all share that one model, so we have it in one place. Nice to have consistency around it. We can also extend it so that we can put more information there as well. It's really great. Make more capabilities around it. And maybe I only extend it, for example, the partial might only be up in the head, which is one of the things that we did. You know, if you extend it, that way you don't have to worry about serialization coming back down.
Yep.
All right. So, in fact, let me start with property validation. And in fact, so much more than just validation. And this is one of those basic requirements on any line of business application. So here I've got a class that represents players, let's say. And I need to know whether or not I'm allowed to save it. Like, are the changes that were made in this property values appropriate for the database?
I'd actually turn around and say, I'd argue that it's valid for any application. Hmm. So, you know, anywhere where you're actually putting in data, in almost all scenarios, it's going to be validated to some extent. Is it an email address? Does it satisfy the password complexity? Is it a valid username? So on and so forth. So I would say wherever you have data that is going to be stored, you're going to need to do some form of validation on it, most likely.
Yeah, you're right. In fact, let's do even a little bit more. So one of the things we can determine is whether or not the object is dirty. So this means we're not saving objects that don't have any changes whatsoever. I think that's really a valuable thing.
Especially when we start considering the mobile scenario. You know, you're on a phone, you may be on a data plan. You want to minimize the amount of traffic you're sending across on your data plan.
100%, you're right. We also want to be able to provide a way to revert back to the original. That is, I've made a lot of changes in my record. So just imagine a UI with a cancel button, right? Mm-hmm. You want to be able to enable that cancel button. You can say OK to save, but cancel should take me back to where I was before.
And also to do it without having to do a round trip out to your data server.
That's right. That's the easy way out, is to do it that way. But the reality, you want to be able to snap back to where it was before without some crazy monkeying around of more than one copy of the same record in memory at the same time, right? Because you could do that, too. You could clone it and then go back to your clone. But don't mess around with that. All right. Another is to be able to mark it as clean. So this is saying the changes that I made are fine, I accept them, but I don't want to save them, right? Or maybe they've been saved off in a separate process, and I don't want to somehow recycle it. I just want to start over from here. So that's marking it as clean. And then there is this idea of validation that's not only on the property. There is data annotation that you can put on a property that says things like required, or it gives a or it gives a regular expression pattern that says, you know, has to be email or whatever.
Is that available on all the platforms?
It is available on every platform, except it's not available on Windows Phone right now.
Yes, indeed.
But even still, it's just not enough. What I want to be able to do is say, it's valid when first name and last name have a value. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's an all or none of these are first name and last name, valid email, and they've accepted the terms of agreement or whatever it is. And I want to be able to have validation on a model level, not on just an individual property level. So it's cute and it's nice to be able to do individual ones. And maybe every once in a while that is sufficient, to be honest. But I want to be able to do a little bit more. That's what we're going to introduce here. We also want to expose errors in a way that users can act on them. So I want to see errors that says something like my user account record is invalid, but then I want to understand what's wrong with every property. Not just a big list, but I want to go to every property and see what's wrong with that one. And if it's one, two, three, four, five things that are wrong with them, I want all of them. And so we're about to talk about a validation strategy that honestly we have dreamed up. And it solves all these problems. And I would bet if you're a line of business developer already, you've already solved these problems your own way and probably very similarly, to be honest. This is just if you're thinking in your mind, golly, I'd really love to solve the problem of validation inside my models. What's an easy way to do it? Here's a drop-in solution that works like a charm. Here we go. We're gonna change all of our properties basically to be iProperty. That doesn't mean that their properties become rich properties or they're no longer a string or whatever. What it really means is there's a second way of referencing our property with iProperty. And we're going to hold all of these inside a dictionary inside the model itself. But let's just think about it. Imagine if first name had the ability to say dot errors, and I could say all the things that are wrong with just first name. I could say first name dot and then skip down to is enabled, right? I don't even allow you to put first name because you haven't whatever, right?
Yeah, another rule hasn't been satisfied.
Wow, imagine enabling and disabling individual fields based on the rules inside that model, or asking just if first name is valid. Nothing else. I don't care about the rest of the model. Is first name valid, yes or no? So I can disable, highlight, put a little red box around or anything else that I want.
And a great thing from this perspective is this does facilitate a lot of automated testing. That you can set up your rules, you can inject them, and then you can write a bunch of unit tests that drive these and ensure that these state flags get set up correctly.
Right, when you see the base implementation, of course, the way we implement it in Solarizer is a little bit more rich than what I'm about to show you. But when you see the base implementation, this isn't a big deal. The code's pretty lightweight and doesn't add a lot to it, and it does add a lot around testability, you're right. Imagine if you could say first name dot is dirty. Oh, what a lot of power there. Just this one field. Anything wrong with this field? Have they made a change to it or not? Mm-hmm. If they haven't, maintain focus or, you know, whatever it is you want to do. And then finally, those two methods we talked about are about revert, going back to the original, undoing, canceling, or whatever. And then marking is clean, basically accepting all the changes and not counting it as dirty anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's for first name and second name and last name and age and every property down the line. You can do this. You can really build a rich UI around it, showing what needs to be done where. And all right, so let's look at how we might do it. Implementing property T this is the implementation of property T that implements our interface we just talked about, iProperty. It's as simple as this. There's a property. The reason we put T is because we realize that a property can be almost anything. T allows us to make everything generic. So you might have a string property for first name, but you might have an integer property for age, right? Things like that. And so this will handle any of those properties because it goes with T. You can see there at number one, this is just keeping a list of all the errors. It's really great. And number two, this is where we keep the original value and the current value, whatever that is. We can then check those later for whether or not it's dirty. So you can see in number three, the valid and dirty checks are right there. Valid, if there are no errors, then it's valid. If it's dirty, we can by checking whether or not the original matches with the current value. Right? It's just simple logic like that with easy extensibility for if you need something special, because sometimes you do need something special. The ability to revert back then in number four and mark it as clean. Simple as that. Revert simply means make the value what the original was. And mark as clean simply means make the original what the current is. Everything now is set up, and so now is dirty or erased properly. And then is enabled is just true or false, and that gets set by a validator that we have on the model level. There's more implementation you could do to this, absolutely. This is just the basic implementation of the initial property. So what this means is all of your user records are going to have a property of T for every property in it. So let's say I have first name, last name, and let's just say it's first name and last name for now. That's two properties inside my user record. This means I'm going to have three objects. I'm going to have the user object as well as the first name property and the last name property. So let's see how we might implement that inside the model itself. So this is the user record. So iModel is kind of how we will recognize that. And iModel will be important later because it's something that we pass around as well. So look how it's laid out. Imagine if you could say to the user record, you could say dot properties, and it brings back all the properties, and every one of those properties that you get has the full rich capability of saying, is it dirty? Is it, what's the original value? Can I revert? All those different, and whether or not it's valid. Right? Really, really cool. And then we have the observable collection of errors, and we make it observable so we can bind this inside XAML, because we build this out for the framework we know we're going to use it in. And so now inside the errors, that's the aggregate of all of them, right? So now I'm not saying, show me in the errors collection. Well, what would that mean if it doesn't bring all of them together? Yeah, I want to know all the errors in first name, all the errors in last name. That'll be really great. And that allows me to give, I could give a summary at the end. We can't save your record because of, and then give them a nice long list of whatever it is. Then here's the validator. So this is just a simple delegate that we give it. And so the validator is a method that I write. And this is different for everybody. This is really the custom implementation part. It holds it for sure, but it's the custom implementation. How is it that I want to validate whatever it is that I'm using? So I just put it right there, whatever that method is. If there's not one, then it's never dirty, or then it's never invalid, right? It's always an option. So that means you can make all of your models inherit or, and implement iModel and not worry about whether or not you have to build out all the validation right away. You certainly don't. Then, of course, on the model level, I can check, is it valid? Is it dirty? I could tell it to validate right now, which would update all of the errors as well as return whether or not it's valid. I could revert all of them at once. I could mark all of them clean at once. And basically, that's just an aggregate operation against all the properties. Okay, this is the a potential implementation, sort of a little bit of pseudocode, to be honest. But and by the way, this may be pseudocode, but the implementation inside Solarizer is 100% legit. So if you're looking at this and you're really interested in it, and you're like, I'd like to see this in operation, we did it right there in Solarizer all the way across the board. So here we are. This is model-based, so that means my user account, it means my everything record that I have out there, all my different models will inherit from model-based. That gives them the properties property of all their properties that we can interact in a rich way. It also gives me that list of errors that's validated. And you can see the logic at the bottom there on number four. The is valid and is dirty interacts with the properties and just does a quick query to make sure, are there any valid? Is there any that are dirty? And it brings back the aggregate answer across the entire model, right? It's really great. And so this is a simplistic implementation. You know, you may have business rules that need to call out and do it a different way. Great. Hey, that's the reason it's just code, right? You can do it your own way. But if you need just a kind of a hit it out of the park in an easy way, this is a great way.
I mean, we found this worked really well.
Yeah, we totally did. All right. Validation in Solarizer.
Yeah.
Ah, this is real. Now, okay, good. So that was... It's something about showing slides with code that just doesn't feel right. So let me pull up Solarizer, and we'll talk about what's inside Solarizer. And I'll do it quickly, because I just did a little quick check for us there. All right, so if we were to look up in inside models here, we can see that we have model base. And model base for us is actually a little bit more complicated because we wanted to know exactly what the ID was as well, so we made it more... more generic, right, where we have two different types. And then, but I want to show, and I'll start with the appointment model. So we actually injected the validation information from the view model. This allowed us to have the model show up in multiple places, but have different validation rules along the way. And so if you go into the view model for appointment page, this is where we inject the validator for the individual appointment. In fact, let me just go down for just a second. I'll grab where it is. Here it is. All right, so this dot appointment represents the property inside this view model that holds the appointment that we're showing on the screen. And it has a validator property, just like we talked about in the interface. This is that delegate that gets executed every time we want to know whether or not it's valid. And here what we can do, and again, because this is just raw code, I can do it any way that I want to. So here it's just a quick check to say the status of that survey that we're filling out. First of all, it's required. This is an unlikely scenario to hit. This would just kind of identify UI that we had done wrong. But then we can make sure that the ID is 1 in this case. And if it's 1, then that means it is pending. And so it's not valid as long as it's pending. And valid for, in our scenario at least, means that we're not allowed to upload it to the server until it's no longer pending. Then I can go here and I can say, what about, are the details, is there anything in there? In this case, I'm just checking quickly to see if it's null or empty. And then I add an error, not an error to the model, but an error to this property. They'll get aggregated down later by all the base implementation for us.
And the nice thing about having this single sort of validator action that runs all of these rules is the ability to be able to scope outside of a particular property. A lot of the previous frameworks that worked in have had validators that are scoped to a particular property, which is all well and good when you're doing require, whether you're doing length, trimming, and checking, and so on and so forth. But then as soon as you try and do the dependencies, then there has to be some additional mechanism by which you do the dependencies, and then getting those errors injected correctly, it's starting to become troublesome. So yeah, I'm a real big fan of unrolling this.
This is not a solid gold solution for every possibility, but this probably does meet the needs of a big percentage of use cases out there that developers run against.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and the ability to move it so that the validator can be reinserted at any time, including by the view model, allows us to change the validation to fit the need of wherever that model's currently being shown. Or we could just make a deal together that the model ships with its validator already in it. Mm-hmm. And so nobody rewrite the validator. We might even make it so it's private setter. And so it all gets set internally. Great. It just depends on what your rules are internally.
Yeah, and if you're striving for testability, you might pull these things out of being encapsulated as an inline Lambda, mm-hmm. as we have, and put them into something else that we can leverage and reference inside unit testing.
That's right. I could have a static class out there that has all the different validators for all the different types of objects. That's exactly right. Okay. Well, let's take a quick look. Validation is part of the basic line of business solution. There's no getting around it. This is an important thing. And I probably would switch it to say what you said. Yep. Validation is a basic part of pretty much all the solutions.
Yeah, anywhere where you're putting data in, that is just not going to be a bucket that you're dumping stuff into. Yep. You're going to want to validate it. Is it an email? Yes or no? Using this solution, we can put a regular expression as part of the validator to evaluate whether it matches an email.
That's right.
So on and so forth. So there's a lot of flexibility there. And there's no real reason not to, because one thing you can guarantee is the one thing that you thought your users would never do is probably the first thing they'll do as soon as you put it into the store.
Boy, that is so true.
And so,
you'll never find every bug until you demo it to an executive. That's my other slogan, too.
Exactly.
All right, let's look back. We did a lot in this module, and it's the stuff that you just see over and over and over again. And you can't really have an MVA dedicated just to this. We can cover it in an hour pretty comfortably. But this is the sort of thing you would see and is completely compatible with a universal application on the modern platform.
And that's the key thing, is that this capability is 100% shareable across both heads.
That's right.
And so that's really where it ties into,
including your .NET project that you have going on.
Exactly.
So we talked about the database project. That's the type of project inside Visual Studio that allows you to build out your application or build out your database, and you can use it really nicely for developers to be able to have a fresh schema as well as commit their schema into source control. Really great. We also talked about the web API in general, creating that service. We just used the simplest scaffolding, but we got everything we needed from it. And we'll talk later about securing it. But we also talked about using the Entity Framework as the shim to the database, and then kind of sneaking away the TT that it builds and puts it up into the reusable portable class library mm-hmm. that we have. Finally, we called the web API, just demonstrating how the HTTP client is really easy to use, yep, and kind of how Newtonsoft JSON.NET is implemented, makes it real simple as well.
Yeah, a few quick tips around that. Sometimes, you know, most of the time, you're actually going to want to check your response object, because if for whatever reason the resource isn't found, you've mistyped your resource and so on and so forth, you will get HTTP status coming back that tells you what's going on. Obviously, the implementation we did there was a pretty naive, assume everything is right and deserialize it. Sometimes you might actually get back an error page or something like that in terms of the content that's coming back. And so if you try and deserialize JSON from an HTML error page, you're going to get something a little bit fatal.
are no try catches in that.
Exactly. Day. So, you know, once we actually get into Sailorizer proper, we can show you kind of more of a secure way of implementing those things.
Yep, that's right. Finally, we talked about validation, the need for validation in almost every project. And then what may be one of the simplest solutions that meets the needs of what's got to be a gigantic set of all the use cases out there developers are hitting against. So we have the database, we have the service, reusable templates, we have property validation. This was a full hour, and oh my gosh. Barry, Barry, Barry. All right, so. did you see anything?
No.
I lost my train of thought. When there's a monkey on your shoulder, on your back, oh, that's good.
A virtual monkey on your back.
There's a virtual monkey on your back. How did he do that?
A doctor, not a physicist.
That's so true. It's Doc, that's Bones. We're at the end of this module, and we're going to take a 10-minute break. We're going to come back and start talking about MVVM frameworks and their implementation. There's a lot to it, but it's simpler than you probably think. Again, solves a lot of problems for you really quickly. We'll see you in 10 minutes.